Welcome to this podcast of Sunday nights on ABC Local Radio. I hope you enjoy the program. Hi there, great to have you with us. Well, in the midst of all the hustle and bustle and toil and trouble of an election campaign, I want to ask a question tonight. What is your purpose in life? Yes, do you ever think about it in more than a casual sense? Phrased that way, of course, it's only meaningful if you believe that there is something overarching, some overarching scheme of meaning that we are in some way obliged to be part of. I could just as easily say, what's your aim in life? To be happy? Make money? Have friends? To be influential? But to what end? Is the question of purpose and meaning in life now just a hangover from a past that saw direction and meaning as necessary to rewards at the end of the journey? If there's no judgment at the end of the road, then why bother with any purpose other than self-fulfillment? If social aspirations are largely determined by a relativized value set in a world saturated in consumer choice, what's the point of questing? Well, for young people these days, to plot a course in life that contains anything more than maximized self-interest is a much harder road than it was for their baby boomer parents and grandparents. So tonight, whilst the babble of an election campaign centred mainly on gotcha journalism and appeals to populist prejudice rolls throughout the country, we're going to speak of the appeal of higher things. As one politician called Lincoln once put it, an appeal to the better angels of our nature, the purposeful life. Is it worth striving for, and what are its essential elements? You can join the conversation when we're joined by a panel who shared their thoughts on purpose in Melbourne this week at a conference for that purpose. In our second hour, someone who's thought deeply about such matters over many years of disciplined, purposeful living, theologian and commentator Ronald J. Sider. Since the publication of his book Rich Christians in an Age of Hunger, Ron Sider has been something of a gadfly on the conscience of conservative Christianity. In one of his more recent books called The Scandal of the Evangelical Conscience, Ron Sider observed that for all their moral uprightness, the figures for divorce, sex before marriage, charitable giving and other key indicators, the figures for evangelical Christians are much the same as for other sectors of society. Ron Sider will be along in about an hour. Then the quiz, Noel and the Good Life, and finally the chat room with Angela McCarthy in Perth, where this week there's been some consternation over the question of the burqa. Will a Muslim woman be required to remove her face covering in order to testify in court? It raises all sorts of profound questions. Well, perhaps questions that would be profound if we took the issue seriously. And what about Cardinal George Pell today in a newspaper column calling on Christians not to vote for the Greens? Another one of those issues you might wish to talk about when it's time for the chat room with Angela McCarthy in about 3 hours from now. But first, before all of that, it's been a very busy day for some. Today was the feast day of Mary MacKillop, the last on which she'll be remembered as blessed. If events go as announced, next year this will be her saint's day. And someone who's been close to the process for the past couple of years is the Australian Ambassador to the Holy See, Tim Fisher. Mr. Ambassador, welcome to Sunday Night, an important day today. The countdown begins in earnest.
Greetings, John, and yes, always nice to be back in awesome Australia.
Was it a busy day for you today, or were you able
Sydney was absolutely glistening. It was on fire. What, there were 80,000 people stomping down William Street to Bondi Junction. Bronte Beach was glistening. Huge masses over there in North Sydney. 9/11, 1 and 3, I think, at or near the Mary MacKillop Centre. And the bells of not one but two cathedrals at one stage ringing out, including St. Andrew's Anglican Cathedral, which I only recently discovered, John, just to digress 1 second, is perhaps the only cathedral in the world that used to worship to the east. Then it worshipped to the west for 45 years, and then it swung back and entered the 21st century worshipping to the east one more time.
Well, the Anglicans have been known to straighten out their positions every now and again, haven't they?
That's true. Indeed. I think the Reverend David Richardson's back from Rome at the moment too and may well be listening, so we better behave.
We'd better behave. Well, tell us about your experience of the whole day, because you've been now involved in this for some 3 or 4 years. You've given your heart and soul to it. In many ways, you've been seen as the principal Australian sort of flag carrier on the issue. How's it been today for you?
Well, I am not, because these are matters essentially for the internalities of the Catholic Church and the whole process of canonisation. Sister Anne Derwin, the head of the Sisters of St Joseph, Sister Maria Casey, Cardinal Pell and Archbishop Philip Wilson of Adelaide form what we call the Gang of Four, which is coordinating and leading the detail of the preparations for the 17th of October. But yes, as ambassador, I mean, the Australian government, the Department of Foreign Affairs and Trade and others have instructed me to be clear-cut. This is a matter of public diplomacy. This is a matter of great moment, a great recognition of an extraordinary Australian in the very competitive hub of Rome. And this will take place on the 17th of October, 9:30 a.m. in St. Peter's Square with several thousand Australians. So yes, we're facilitating with information, we're facilitating in other ways, and at the very least, I am putting on a morning tea, hosting it for the Sisters of St. Joseph only on the Friday morning, the 15th of October. About 135 of those coming to Rome from various parts of the world, mostly Australia. And I think that will be a nice way to start the proceedings.
You've mentioned that one event on the 15th. You, of course, have had... you've sort of talked down your role a little there in that you've been somebody who's been very willing to facilitate in this. Over that weekend, I would imagine things will be fairly busy because the Mass itself, there are a number of people, including John Henry Newman, being recognised in that Mass on the Sunday. Mary MacKillop is only one for a huge international audience who'll be gathered. So you're doing something about sort of corralling the rest of the Australians and pointing them in a certain direction? You know,
there's a lot happening, John. Example, on the Friday night... a special night, Una Notte Australiana, in the Vatican Museum. And Father Mappelli, the director of the Ethnological Museum in the Vatican, is visiting Australia in the next fortnight. You might like to track him down for an interview. He's coming down through Darwin to Broome, Bishop Chris Saunders, the Kimberleys. Why is all this aspect happening? And it'll involve anyone who wants to book into the museum on that Friday night. It's open till 11 p.m. that night. The Vatican Museum will be able to see part of some acts relating to Mary MacKillop and the Indigenous. All this brings back to something very peculiar. In 1925, the Pope ordered and asked for a collection of Aboriginal artefacts from Australia, from the Kimberleys, and over 300 items were assembled, sent to Rome. They've been rediscovered, they've been recatalogued, they're going to go on exhibition, and one or two of them will be on exhibition on this fabulous mid-weekend of October 2010. So that will happen on the Friday night. On the Saturday, the Sisters of St. Joseph will have their vigil, concert and prayer group. And then on the Sunday, 9:30, the canonisation proper. On the Monday, 10:30 a.m. at St. Paul's, outside the walls, there will be the Mass in appreciation. And all of this to be helped, facilitated in a very proper way by wines of excellence from a region I shouldn't name on your program other than to say it's right next to Panola. It begins with C, and that's where Mary MacKillop opened her first school in 1866.
Will you allow that small promotional vehicle there? Mr. Ambassador, let me ask you something about yourself. There was a story circulating today that you're sort of hanging up your shingles shortly. Is that true or not?
Well, it's not true. I'm doing my three-year contract, and it was a sub-editor put a curious headline on an article a couple of days ago, just ahead of that fabulous night at the Sydney Town Hall, a buzz of a night, 700 people in salute of Mary MacKillop, organised by Kathy Harris and Emma Rossi and a few others. And the headline sort of said, I'm quitting. Well, I am quitting at the end of a three-year term, which commenced in January 2009, so I will complete that contract at the end of 2011 or early 2012, third week of January 2012. So I'll do the 3 years, no more, no less, as things were planned and as I'm prepared to do. And it's a great honour and privilege to represent the Australian government, the Australian Parliament, to the, if you like, nation, city, state of the Holy See itself a member of the United Nations.
Tim Fisher, we wish you well in the very busy time that's now going to consume you between now and the 17th of October, and we trust we might catch you up on the event or just after the event to get your reaction to it. Thanks for joining us on Sunday night.
John, arrivederci. We are both driven and purposeful, so there you are. There's something to start your discussions with later tonight.
Thank you indeed. Tim Fisher, Australian Ambassador to the Holy See and all-round good fellow, and it's now 69 days, 20 hours and 43 minutes and some seconds to the event in Rome. Well, what is your purpose in life? It's a question that once upon a time was the benchmark of high-minded citizenship. These days, it's more likely to be delivered with an ironic twist that quickly leads to a shop till you drop reply. Well, on Sunday night, we've brought together some psychologists, educators and theologians to test the merits of a purposeful life. Direct from the Christian Research Association conference on the theme, it's a pleasure to welcome once again the director of the CRA, Philip Hughes, together with Tim Sprod of the Friends School in Hobart, and they're together in our Melbourne studios. Welcome to you both.
Thank you.
Thank you, John.
And in Brisbane, June DeVoe, psychologist and educator, and in Sydney from the Australian Catholic University, Graham Rossiter. Welcome to you all. Good to have you. June DeVoe, let me come to you first. Do people need a sense of meaning and purpose? Or perhaps I should ask if meaning and purpose are not two different things.
I think that meaning and purpose are two sides of the same coin. And the answer's, I think, very simple. They do, because a sense of meaning and purpose is correlated with well-being. And it is across the world, and most people report a sense of meaning and purpose.
Does that mean in some ways it's sort of part of our who we are, that in some ways it's psychologically hardwired, that we need a sense of order in order to give coherence to life, in order to impose order on the environment in which we move? That is, it could be explained purely naturalistically.
Possibly. At this point, I should point out that my role in the Educating for Purposeful Life conference was, as a clinical psychologist, to comment on the role of positive emotions on mental health. And I would like to keep to that role here.
You're welcome to stretch yourself, if you'd like.
Oh, I might, but I might stick to my area of expertise at the moment.
Philip Hughes, why did you bring such a conference together?
There's two foundations for it. I'm chair of the Council of Kingswood College, and the Kingswood College is committed to a holistic education, and so we were looking partly at how we could do our holistic education better in contemporary society. The other side of it is, as the researcher in the Christian Research Association, I've found that about 80% of young people around Australia say that at least sometimes they really don't know what to think about life and the world. And that certainly has an impact on their sense of well-being, on their sense of confidence in life. So it was those two things. I think post-modernity, or whatever you call this age where sort of a lot of the boxes and the duties and the sense of what life is about have become much more personalised, something that young people feel they've got to develop for themselves rather than be given them, has left young people with that task of finding a sense of meaning and purpose for themselves. And so the educational task is, how can we prepare them to do that wisely?
Tim Sprod, speaking about young people and the sort of environment they're in, of course, this question has been one that's been common to sort of high school syllabus since the 60s when young people were introduced to Sartre and Camus and the existentialist, and the question is, if there is no ultimate meaning, can you have any personal meaning? It's not a new question, but it's being asked in different ways today.
Well, I think it's a much older question than the 60s and Camus and Sartre. Camus and Sartre and the existentialists, I wouldn't say that they've had a huge impact on young people. I'd say the vast majority of young people have probably never heard of either of them. In fact, in the English-speaking world, almost uniquely around the world, young people don't study any philosophy at all. In my view, these questions are philosophical questions, and they're very important questions, and in my view, we should be teaching, or we should be helping kids to learn how to do philosophy. I want to pick up on something that Philip said. I think it's quite right that in today's world there's an emphasis on being authentic. And now that's a word that Sartre particularly placed a lot of emphasis on. And for Sartre, to be authentic was to choose your own values. It seems to me, and the Canadian philosopher Charles Taylor says this, that authenticity is about choosing by yourself, but it's not, as Sartre would say, choosing from within yourself solely. I think those choices must be made within community, within the wider communities in which we live, and that for students at school to explore these issues in communities, in schools, in communities of inquiry, is how they can develop a sense of purpose. We might distinguish between a purpose of life or finding a purpose in life. A purpose of life might be something that's demanded of us, but it might well be that we can find purposes in life that that we develop from within our place in community. I think that's important, and so I think a lot of kids have missed out on that.
That particularly that word community.
Well, on the inquiry as well, the inquiry within their community into big, important questions. I think we have become quite successful at teaching students in schools how to learn in all the various disciplines and so on, but we've missed out on helping them to explore their own lives and their lives within the broader community in which they exist.
Graham Rossiter, you're an educator. You've spent some part of your life concerned with these issues. What's the climate with kids in schools these days? And as you as an educator approach it, what do you think the in some ways, educators have to scratch where people are itching, don't they, if they're going to make it bite? So where's the itch these days?
Well, if you look at it from the educator's point of view initially, if anybody has behaviour, there's going to be some implied meaning in what they do. The thing is, do they reflect on it? Do they think about it in the light of what the world culture has to say? So that's where education comes in. Then the other thing is that perhaps the difficulty is lots of young kids live a life that is so fast-paced. They're more concerned with lifestyle than with spirituality, and so it's a bit difficult to get them to reflect. But I think we hang in there in the hope that in handing on some sense of intellectual culture in education, that we also teach them how to think and how to reflect. And there's some scope there for getting them.
So in some senses, and I'll just get you, Graham, to extend this a little bit, in some senses, what you're engaged there in is a critique not so much on where kids are now, but where education has been for the last 20 or 30 years as well.
Yes. If you look at Australian education, the aims that come out from the Australian Education Council will reflect things like spiritual values, but then very little is done about that in general education. I think the church-related schools have a stab at that in their religion programs. But if most of the kids are not going to become card-carrying members of any tradition, well, then maybe we should aim at doing something that will enable them and skill them to look more critically at what's happening and chart their way with a little bit of help from what we do in schools.
Well, let's have a broader look at that now. June Devoe, let me bring you back in here. You mentioned earlier you're interested in the way in which a positive aspect of life, the things that give people some sense of confidence and reinforcement. How important are two or three words I'll throw at you here? First of all, the word community. How important is community to a sense of self-esteem and positive identification for people?
Well, I think certainly for adults in midlife and later life, I'm not convinced that adolescents think a lot about that. And to backtrack over what I said earlier about wanting to keep to my area of expertise, what I see as a clinical psychologist is that adolescents are deeply engaged with a sense of purpose and meaning at their stage of life in working out what they want to do. And I think it's in engaging with others that the progression seems to be from a development of a sense of who one is in relationships with others. And then that, when that's firmly established and there's some spare time, which can take quite a while, one extends out into the community. I'm not overly convinced that a sense of community is ever going to be on an adolescent's radar. Unless it directly influences their sporting activities, where they go skateboarding, or which shopping malls they like to hang out in.
Yes, I guess the real developmental question at that stage is, who am I, not who are we?
And I think the achievement in a relationship is a major milestone which paves the way for a sense of meaning. But the point I made at the conference was that a sense of meaning and purpose requires time to put that into action. The adolescent has time to think about study choices and career, but most adults struggle to find the time to reflect on what they're doing with their lives, and it comes and goes over the lifespan and often emerges in the over 50s because they have more time, theoretically.
Take us back a little, though. I mean, one could go back generationally and say, look, 30 or 40 years ago or maybe 50 years ago, young people, even though during those adolescent years they were obsessed with the question of self-identity before they could sort of move on to other questions, that was still had the opportunity to express itself within wider structured communities, be they churches or community organisations or whatever. There was a much broader platform in which young people could be engaged to find those kids.
But what about the churches? Their parents took them.
Yes.
The parents aren't taking it.
Well, it's a question I'm asking, though, is that a factor today that influences where kids are culturally? The fact that they don't have those opportunities these days that they once had?
Well, again, to draw on my experience as a clinical psychologist, I am regularly inspired by my adolescent clients. I think they think deeply about the meaning in their context, and their context now differs because I don't meet many that are going to church or taken to such places, but I meet young people who are quite determined to make sense of their lives in the way that they now do.
So what are the questions they ask that would extend beyond themselves?
What am I going to do?
Yeah.
What am I going to study? What am I going to do? And it's the usual pitfalls of trying to avoid fitting into something because it's safe, which I'm sure is something we've all been through, juggling the safety or the expectations with a real desire to do something that reflects their own direction, their own talents. And I think young people are still doing that. And they do it so determinedly. If they make a mistake, they do it again, which one can see very clearly at university level.
Do you think the horizons are more limited these days than they once were? That is there, for example, one takes the example of television and the way it sort of presents in some ways a monoculture of values?
I find that a very difficult question to answer. My first thought is no. I think that our age group, look, I'm over 50. I'm not quite sure about everybody else's ages here.
We're all safely over the boundary.
Oh, right. Okay. I just think we don't see it. I mean, I watch my grandchildren playing, you know, computer games on iPhones, I think at age 5. I actually think that we see these things as limiting in monoculture. I don't think they do. And the results when I see adolescents from 16 through to young adults of 24, they seem very engrossed in what they're going to do. And I don't see the evidence that they're coming out of a monoculture. I see a lot of evidence they're not coming out of the culture that I recognise.
Mm. Graeme Rossiter, how do you respond to what June's observing?
Well, one of the film study scholars has said, traditionally we were a community who handed on our values through stories. And now most of the stories in most of the homes, most of the times, are told by television. So they're lacking the cultural religious overlay that used to be there. They're open to all sorts of meanings and purposes. There's no shortage of meaning. The question is, how can you evaluate critically what's being offered? And I think that's the big issue for education. Mm. Can help somewhat in that process. See, these are just kids, and I think the individualism of our culture is forcing on them at an ever, ever younger age having to make up their own minds about things, whereas traditionally you accepted the meaning system of your parents and your local community, local church, and when you're old enough and wise enough, you modified it. Now, age five, they're saying, well, it's a free country, I've got to decide.
Philip Hughes, do you want to respond to what June's observing there?
I think what she's saying is correct in most respects. The one thing I would add is that I've observed young people being very intentional about developing a network of close friends, and the sense of being part of that group is extremely important. Now, I think that what's actually going on there is it's a replacement for the community in which we used to be born. I think that most of us, most young people, they don't feel that they're part of a community, but rather community is something that they create in that development of network of friends. So it's within that context often that the sense of who they are and something of what life is about is often begins to emerge. So it's not purely a personal quest. There are communal dimensions of it in those networks of relationships.
I think you're right, Philip, but what strikes me as interesting is that network of friends are influenced very subtly by prevailing cultural meanings, you know, what they perceive as social reality. And I think we need to help them to become much more discerning of what are these trends in thinking that are having almost an unconscious shaping influence.
There's two things that sort of strike me there, and Tim Sprott, I'll bring you in here. Two things that strike me. One is what Graham's just alluded to. This is the question of breadth. There's a whole lot of alternative cultural meanings. But also, is there not, as you were alluding to earlier, a question of depth, how to introduce people to the depth of a tradition, whether it's Western civilization or however you want to phrase it, a depth of thinking and meaning that allows them to be ready at whatever stage they are to move into sort of those big decisions, to have a sufficient breadth and depth of understanding to make those decisions in a way which works for the best for them.
Yeah, and they also need the tools and capabilities to be able to do that as well. So what I would argue is that in schools we need to be creating the opportunities for our children to explore all the possibilities that are out there, because I agree with Graham that there are many. They are trying to create their own identities, as June said, but I don't think that identity creation is something that takes place in a vacuum. I think that, I'd add to the questions that the kids ask that I hear. One of the main questions they say is, what is the sort of person that I want to be? And so they're trying to create their own, well, this is the question of their own identity.
It doesn't happen in vacuo, though, does it?
No, it doesn't. I mean, it does happen in their interaction with those around them. It happens in the family. It happens in that group of friends that Philip's been talking about. It happens in all sorts of communities. I don't want to take the word community to mean just the national community or something like that. Communities can be of all sorts of different sizes, and they do need time, and they do need to reflect. But we can't just say to kids, well, you know, sit in the corner and reflect. They have to learn how to reflect, and they learn how to reflect, it seems to me, by reflecting publicly with others, hearing others reflect, and then gradually internalizing that ability to reflect, that ability to judge, to weigh up, to evaluate, the ability to look for depth, the ability to search for the assumptions underlying positions that they're offered, the implications of those positions, and all of this. It seems to me we need to be creating the conditions within school classrooms where our students have the ability to develop the tools, to experiment with this, to find out, and above all, to ask the questions that matter to them. You asked about, you know, which is the itch that should be scratched. Well, the best way to find that out is to ask the students themselves, what do you want to talk about? What matters to you?
June DeVoe, is there a question here of the range of experience which kids are offered? That is, to maximise the range of possibilities for them in order to help them reach a level of competence which enables them to move through those stages of moving from who am I to who am I in community and who am I in relation to others. Those sorts of questions require or are best facilitated when there's a greater range of experience available to them.
Well, I think the reference to having time to reflect in public, just first up, I mean, I think that's a very good suggestion. As a psychologist, of course, one gets to reflect with the client for an hour, you know, one week and an hour the next. And the client, the young person, has that reflection available. In schools, I actually think that's a great suggestion, that indeed it's very important. And those reflections often take place within meaningful conversations with teachers and other students. So I think that is extremely important. I think young people often use that very well. As to the range of experiences, look, I'm uncertain about that. I think that an ordinary school life provides a great range of experiences if teachers and students engage well or they have good discussions. It depends what you mean. If you mean taking children to other cultures and other countries, and expecting them to find something there they can't find within their own community and relationships, I doubt it. I think that...
It's extraordinary when you do get students in school into a dialogue, a community of inquiry, and they express their own views and their opinions and their take on life. It's extraordinary how often kids will afterwards say to you, I just didn't know that, you know, my friends thought differently than me about this or that. You know, they know, you know, that they don't support the same football team or something like that, but they don't get the opportunity to discuss deeper matters with each other. And, you know, when they hear what their friends are saying, there is plenty of diversity in even the most monocultural classroom. And, you know, to get kids to bring that out into the open and to discuss it with each other, to test those ideas for their coherence and you know, whether they hold up to scrutiny and perhaps even to change their minds about things if they see that what they've taken for granted doesn't really hold up. I think that's very important.
June DeVoe, what do you think the role of the teacher is here?
Well, from a psychologist's perspective, to engage the child. And I think that's a very difficult task. But
the teacher has a social function, though, as well as a function for the child.
Yes,
the teacher
does.
Is there
yes,
as an agent of society in one sense.
Yeah, well, that is true. I'm not going to comment on that. I'm sorry, but I'm a psychologist. I'm sticking to what I know. When I see adolescents in my consulting room, what they talk about is a teacher's capacity or otherwise to engage. That is what occupies their mind with me.
And you'll get some fairly descriptive.
You hear some great stories. You know, you see the important role teachers can play. Yes, you do hear some very, you know, unsuccessful stories, but that's how it is. And it's a very difficult role, I think, teaching, but it is a very important one. One really, you know, a young person who is disillusioned with school, who doesn't know why they're studying what they're studying, or who doesn't know what to do with their lives, or wants to leave school because they feel school is not suitable, a good, meaningful dialogue at that point can be very significant.
You're on Sunday night on ABC Radio around Australia, via Radio Australia and through the web to the world. We're talking about purposeful life. How, in the midst of a sort of postmodern, relativized society, do young people find meaning? When things like churches are no longer around to provide it as a first course of reference, and perhaps television is, where do you think young people are picking up their sense of meaning? And is it important that people do have a sense of meaning in life? Our guests are June DeVoe, psychologist from Brisbane, Graham Rossiter from the Australian Catholic University in Sydney, Tim Sprod from the Friends School in Hobart, and Philip Hughes of the Christian Research Association. Your calls are welcome, 1300 800 222. Graham Rossiter, you've been listening very carefully there, and you were just biting to say something a moment ago. Off you go.
Well, look, a lot of our conversation tonight has focused on the introspective and the personal. What does it mean for me to become this? What sort of a person do I want to become? Now, I think that's all very good and we need some of that, but the intensity of that is more appropriate for the mentoring, the counselling, the therapy group. When you get into the classroom with 25 young people, I think it's a mistake to try to make it that personal. You then have to look at something that's out there. You look at the questions of meaning and purpose in culture, in history, and so on. And they can get into that much more easily than they can slip into deeply personal, reflective stuff. And you hope that if you've got a good curriculum, you've got something out there that prompts them to think later. And for the critical element, I go back to that famous quotation by Postman and Weingartner in their book 1969, they said, all kids are born with an inbuilt crap detector, and one of our key roles as educators is to refine that instrument. And I think there's a lot of mileage in getting kids to look at culture, how it has a shaping influence, and I think that then transfers a lot to personal reflection.
My copy of that book is sort of buried somewhere under a deep pile. Teaching as a subversive activity.
Dog-eared, yes.
Here we are. See, we're all children of a certain vintage.
If I can come in here, I think Graham's right, but I think there's more than just the curriculum we have to look at here, and we have to look at pedagogy as well. We have to look at what teachers actually do with kids in the classroom. And to my mind, creating a community of inquiry which engages in meaningful dialogue, and I agree, you know, that we can't go straight to the intensely personal here, but the personal and the communal, the social and the cultural are all tied up together, and by creating the conditions under which students can ask the questions that really matter to them about these issues and then can discuss them and can kick around various ways of seeing it, and get asked to defend their views, to listen seriously to others, to actually make judgments and evaluations on things for good reasons, well supported. And this is how we support them in honing those tools and capabilities I was talking about, to be able to make deep decisions for themselves, because they are made initially in dialogue with others and then they are internalised, and that's when kids can use them for themselves in their own personal reflections.
Philip Hughes, you're somebody who has got an interest in social science, in measuring how people respond to things. Some reason for you pulling together a conference like this has to be an underlying concern about whether or not the current generation of young people has adequate resources in coming to mature decisions or understandings about the nature of community, about where they sit, about extended relationships. What are your figures telling you? What's the social science saying about the current generation?
I think there's a great diversity of young people there. That's what the research has suggested, that there are some young people who thrive on the wealth of options that are available in our culture, who are able to think and discern and to evaluate and find what works for them and to move forward. But I also found in my surveys and in interviews that there's a range of young people who are overwhelmed by the choices in front of them, who don't feel that they've got the tools to deal with those, many who actually sort of almost proceed in life by default because they haven't really had the encouragement to really evaluate where they should be going. So there is that diversity. I do think that if we're going to do holistic education well, then we need to be providing young people with the tools for thinking. We need to be providing them with stimuli that encourage them to look at the wider world, the world around them, the influences upon them within culture and so on. So I do think that education can do more than it's doing within our current social context.
Is there any larger degree, Philip Hughes, of uncertainty in our society now than there was in the past? And is there a sense of, as you know, you talk sort of, you look at the pop headlines in the newspapers, where it's the tabloid press. There's a sense of anxiety which is constantly conveyed about the younger generation. Now, I guess this is as it ever was, but is there a sense that there is a difference now with young people than there was, say, 30 years ago or even 50 years ago, or are we just engaging in populist myth-making here?
I do believe that there is a difference. I do think that there was a much more was given to us 50 years ago in terms of what our world was about. You go back to even 1971. You still had 86% of Australians who described themselves as Christian. Most people believed in God. There was a lot of commonality within our culture, and I believe that there is a much greater degree to which young people now feel that they must make decisions about a lot of things that people just didn't even think about in the past. I believe a whole range of issues about ethics, about relationships and so on were opened up in the 70s. And people said, you don't have to follow the tradition. Now, that was good and that was fine. But what it meant was that then we had to decide for ourselves, in fact, how we were going to live.
June, has this thrown a greater weight on kids these days? Is there any sign of that kids are more, insecure for longer? Or I mean, I guess I'm going to get the wrong one.
Certainly that they struggle with the multitude of choices, yes. I see a lot of evidence for that. In fact, when I was at the conference with Philip the other day, one of the younger teachers in the middle of a workshop group simply said, there are too many choices, you know. You've got to make all these decisions. And she would have, I think, been in her early 20s. But that's very common. Mm. It's a confusion over all the choices, not only about what you're going to do in terms of that kind of purpose and meaning, but how to fit in the relationships and the travel and the house and the mortgage. And it's all an individual path that you've got to decide on the way. I also think that people we are learning to gauge our success with how good we feel about our progress through these things, and we're not very well armed against disappointment and negative feeling, which was actually my role in a conference, that side of it.
Let me just, we've only got 5 minutes to go. Let me ask a broader question now. And it goes to this question of feeling good about yourself. It's one thing to feel good about yourself, but if I give an absurd counterpoint, it may have been that Adolf Hitler felt good about himself. I mean, so the good about yourself is not an end in itself. And I guess that is a crunch question. Mm-hmm. And what role does psychology play in that, June? Because people can feel good about themselves in a way that's ultimately dysfunctional for either themselves or maybe for other people.
Well, that was that is very true. And there's certainly some evidence in our culture that we value positive emotions very highly because they let us know that we're succeeding and are doing a good job. We're getting progressively less able to handle negative emotions, and that there's a real strain in having to keep up the positive side. Mm. Your point about Hitler feeling good, for example, that is feeling good without an adequate value system and value for others, is a trap. And I think psychology at the moment is not distinguishing well. To give one example, you may have heard of the Nunn study. It's a famous study where I think it was Martin Seligman and his group looked at the diaries of nuns entering convents back at the beginning of last century, and they did an analysis of their emotion terms and found those with the strongest emotion, positive emotion terms, lived longest. This is used as an example of how positive emotions help us live longer and be happy. But if you look at the authentic happiness inventory questionnaire, which Seligman has devised, you will see that his happiness inventory includes feeling extraordinarily successful, getting what I want, being very proud of myself, and if I were keeping score in life, I'd be far ahead. Now, I can't see those nuns back there filling in that questionnaire and saying, gee, that's me. So whatever we're measuring about feeling good, it isn't what those nuns entered the convent with.
Yes.
So we're picking the eyes out of this and picking the positive feelings and then saying that's what gives us health. Now, I don't think the nuns would have filled in this questionnaire that way.
Yes. And the other important question you ask there is positive feeling an end in itself, and is it ultimately conducive of a wider sense of goodness and health? And that, I guess, is the key question for educators. Tim, it comes back to sort of philosophical questions, that one.
Yeah, that's right. I think feeling good about yourself is a great thing, but you need to feel good about yourself for good reasons. And, you know, to feel good about yourself for bad reasons is not an indicator of a healthy individual in a healthy community, it seems to me.
So if common, well, you might say in our culture, Christian values are not so well known today, what is increasingly necessary is that communities work toward establishing what is our consensus on common values, because this is going to be the set of criteria they're used for judging and evaluating what is appropriate. So I think that's terribly important.
And to wind,
I absolutely agree with that.
Yeah. And to get a round of comment just in the last 2 or 3 minutes, many people, for example, and I'll shift gears entirely, have said that this current election campaign is one in which the journalism is concentrating purely on gotcha moments. It's all about the instant of, oh, this politician made that slip, or this politician made that slip. There are no questions that go deeper than who made the fatal flaw today. The questions of direction, of purpose and meaning are deliberately not being asked because focus groups are telling them, don't ask these questions.
It's a soap opera, and we should be concerned with the real values that are underpinning life, and I think, unfortunately, we're not getting well served here.
June, your reflections on that?
I would agree with that, but I would take you back to your comment about Christian values. I mean, I think to have a successful relationship, whether you're a Christian or not, you need to have many of those values. Without them, you won't have a successful relationship.
Exactly.
Yeah, and many of these values predate Christianity. They, you know, you find wide agreement amongst many cultures about what core values should be. It seems to me that religions very often pick up on what are basically human values and reinforce them, and good on them for doing that. But you don't have to be a Christian to have good values.
Philip Hughes, briefly, we've got about a minute or so to go. Just winding up, your observations from the conference about the sort of things that came out finally from the conference.
We certainly looked at a wide range of ways in which we can create a better environment, I think, is the best way of putting it, for young people to engage with the bigger questions. And perhaps the current level of political debate is indication that that's been missing to some extent in the past. I mean, there's the personal aspects of it, but there is also the whole social aspect of it, as what sort of society do we really want? And I think to be educating young people, to be asking those sorts of questions, to be raising them with them, to be giving them the tools by which to think through them and evaluate them, I think that that's a critical part of education and will ultimately benefit our whole nation.
More history, more ethics, more philosophy. You heard it here, folks, on Sunday night on ABC Radio around Australia. Thanks to our guests, June DeVoe, Graham Rossiter, Tim Sprod and Philip Hughes. This has been a podcast of Sunday Nights on ABC Local Radio. Thank you for listening.